Accession number 27460, reel 14.
Mr. Wilkes, reel 14. You'd said that the journey to the Goldfields had been a bad one. What was the problem?
Some of the engines weren't running very well. Brakes were sticking on, and I was having to free those off. Just temporary measures until we got to camp. And then, of course, in the army, you always obey the last order. And that's to be done without question. So I found myself running three ways, obeying the sergeant painting signs, trying to get the vehicles going as they ought to, and doing the normal routine work on the vehicles. I did come under some criticism eventually for this, but that happened after being there about 2 or 3 months. Now, Kola, where we were stationed, the camp at Kola Goldfields was 7 miles from the town of Kola. And there were three actual goldfields down there. There was Champion Reef, Nundi Droog, and Kola. And down there, the different mines all had canteens to which the troops were invited. But it was a case of getting there. Our colonel would not allow any transport to be used. So there was a lot of discontent, and the colonel wasn't appreciated. I regret, because I did like the colonel, but this was something that he just didn't do to please the troops. However, he got promoted, and his successor immediately looked at the situation, and he arranged that three vehicles would go down to Kola every evening after the guard was mounted. Two would leave at 6 o'clock and one at 7 o'clock. And the one that went at 7 o'clock would bring those that had a late night pass back. Now, this went down very well. And I wish I could remember this colonel's name, because they told me that he had taken demotion to come back to a field regiment, but he didn't stay with us long, and he was re-promoted and went ahead. Anyway, he had me into the office, and he looked at my record and saw that I'd been a Lance Bombardier for quite a while, and he wondered why I hadn't been promoted and why I was disobeying orders, which in actual fact I wasn't, but you always obey the last order. And when I explained what was happening to me, he turned a sympathetic ear to me, and he immediately said, I'm going to give you an opportunity. I'm going to promote you to bombardier forthwith. He said, for 3 months on APRO. He said, at the end of that 3 months, if there isn't an improvement, I'll bounce you to the bottom. And so I went out, and he also, at the same time, arranged for a chap that could do sign writing to come and help me, and someone also to help with the workshop work. And where I'd had this bombardier in England had been put over me, he'd been transferred to the battery when we got back, and he was waiting to become a sergeant. So they gave me a Lance Bombardier under me, who was a regular and a very clever chap. And we worked fine together, and we got over all the problems.
Do you remember his name?
Gannon.
So now you had your own little unit, in effect, over which you were in command, in charge.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And did that alter your tasks? I mean, you talked about three types of tasks there.
I stopped painting signs.
Because you had someone for...
Yes. Yeah. And I had the toilets under control, and I could concentrate on getting all the vehicles fixed up.
He'd become quite a general dog's body, hadn't you, in a way?
I had, yes. I was just made a convenience of. But, I tried to do everything to the best of my ability. I never refused to do anything.
So you had no problems from now on? You had your...
I could cope very well now.
Well, you've mentioned the problems with the vehicles from coming off the ships.
Yes.
In India itself, did vehicles have specific problems, again, caused by conditions?
Yes. Our petrol used to come in 4-gallon petrol cans. How these cans were filled, I just do not know, but we used to suffer an awful lot with water, as much as 25% water sometimes in a can of petrol, and this caused problems. Now, the Canadian and later American vehicles that we got all had water traps on them, but our British vehicles didn't. So I used to run a regular system whereby I checked carburetors and fuel pumps all the time, and water traps on vehicles with water traps. I discovered that if you filtered the petrol through a wash leather, it held the water back and the petrol could go through. And so I managed to get an issue of wash leathers for our drivers, and they put those in the funnel that they were using, and it that greatly improved the situation. It didn't cure it, but it improved it.
I'm surprised that, you know, you could run with water in your petrol.
Well, you didn't. It stopped when it got through.
Was this, do you think, sabotage up the line somewhere?
No, I think possibly the ships that were bringing it in. In those days, ships used to travel one way with fuel, and then they had to put a saltwater ballast in to counter it on the return journey. And I think a lot of this water remained in the tanks.
So that must have been quite a serious problem in the situation that you were in.
To me, it was, but I used to work through these vehicles on a regular basis. Now, when we got to India, I was told that I mustn't expect too long a life from the engines of these vehicles. 6,000 miles was about the limit for a Jeep, a Bedford, a Ford, and a Chevrolet. And I think that was about right. But later on, we discovered, well, a new oil came out, and that solved a lot of problems. But I can come to that later.
Were there any other problems which India brought about with your vehicles?
The biggest one, which to me was a much worse one than the water and the petrol, was the tyres that we got to replace. Now, punctures were always occurring. And unfortunately, the tyres that we were getting to replace, the good old rubber tyres that we had on, were synthetic. And some of them didn't last very long. They used to blow, explode, and all sorts. For all, we had a strict routine when we were in convoy. The tyres used to be checked. A convoy stopped 5 minutes in every hour, and the tyres were checked at those points and adjusted.
Again, were those the main problems that you had?
Yes. It wasn't a problem that we had, but we were instructed that all starter motors had to be disconnected to try and save them. We had to start the engines by the starting handle. That was okay on all the petrol vehicles, but the big diesel gun tractors, they took some starting, and the starting handle had room for three pairs of hands on the handle itself. And there was quite an art in cranking them to the right position where you could get a swing and pull it and it would fire. They were good starters as a rule. But when it threw the starting handle out, invariably it used to catch the radiator and cause the radiator burst. So the starter motors were reconnected, and we didn't have any problems.
That's quite a kick, isn't it, on a starting handle? It could break a man's wrist if he didn't turn it properly.
Of course, timing these engines was, well, In my regiment, I didn't set anything by ear as a rule. I used to set to manufacturer's settings all the time. Consequently, I remember there was an order came out to try and conserve petrol on the Chevrolets. Well, we didn't have a tachometer to check the number of revolutions these engines were going, and we did it just by the second hand on a wristwatch to try and count so many. And I remember the proper setting for the Chevrolets was 360 revolutions a minute. But to save petrol, the order came out that they had to be reduced to 320 revolutions a minute. And we did have an inspection of all the vehicles by someone from the REMI section, an officer, and he would come and meticulously, with a wristwatch, check to see if these vehicles were running at the correct number of revolutions.
Did you have an officer who was MTO, Motor Transport Officer, in the headquarters?
Not as such. Invariably, we did get odd officers that came and went. They were usually in transit either to the battery or something like that when they came, and we did have one or two officers that stayed for a short while.
How many vehicles of all types in total would you be dealing with personally?
Probably about somewhere between 30 and 40.
That's quite a number.
Yes.
And if the engines gave out after the 6,000 miles, what happened to that vehicle? Obviously, it was no good to you.
Well, it didn't happen until we actually went into action, which was some considerable time after. We kept all our vehicles in good order. We did go out on manoeuvres quite often, but they never put up a great mileage. But until we went into action, and then we had some of them taken off us, so that was it. But back at Kola, we were in Kola from about, say, the September 1942 until January 1944.
Quite a while.
It was a while, yes. And we were training. We were 33rd Corps, which was a combined operations corps. And we were doing combined operations exercises when we went on manoeuvres.
Can you describe those to me?
Yes.
With your core artillery unit, how does that fit into a combined operations situation?
Well, as far as headquarters went, we had around us some areas that used to flood that we referred to as tanks. And we used to float, make rafts and things, and float the vehicles out on these rafts and land them again. I remember doing it with a Bren gun carrier, and the blessed thing sank just as we were getting, we were able to start it up and drive it ashore.
And you made your own rafts?
Yes, these were made from four empty 40 gallon petrol barrels with timber roped onto them and roped around the vehicle.
And in the battery situation, was that happening with the guns? Were they being placed on these things?
The guns were usually put on a raft and floated.
That's a proper, what you might call a proper raft, is it?
Yes. Might be a couple of pontoons or something like that.
So you had this, although you got quite large guns, and you had these
exercises to do. But in all fairness, I don't think we did very many of those. And then we went on quite a few manoeuvres which didn't entail floating any vehicles. That was down in the state of Mysore, heading down towards Madras. And invariably, these manoeuvres would sometimes last 10 days, and at the end of them you would manage to have an evening out in Madras. Of course, nobody had any money left by then, had they?
And what were these manoeuvres? What were you actually doing?
Our normal role of supporting infantry and tanks and whatever.
So they were quite large. You had other units involved
as
well.
Oh, yes. Oh, lots of units, yes.
Did any form of jungle training come into this?
Not at this stage. And, you see, we were quite convinced that we were never going east. We were sure we would finish up in Europe.
You go back again, in other words.
That's right.
You go back again.
Anyway, in round about the August-September time of 1943, Lord Louis Mountbatten was appointed Commander-in-Chief, Southeast Asia Command. Now, our colonel that we had at the time, along with several senior officers, all had to go to this big meeting. I think it was at Delhi. It was all very hush-hush. And on their return, we went into intensive jungle training. Lord Louis's instructions were every man had to be primarily an infantryman, every man had to be able to swim, every man had to be able to drive, and you had to be 100% efficient. And of course we entered into this with gusto. We wanted to do our best. My own and Lance Bombardier Gannon's job was to train those people that weren't drivers, and we had a very good success rate. We only had to train them to drive a vehicle from A to B. Teaching them highway code or anything like that didn't come into it. And we would each take three potential drivers, on a Monday afternoon in an open truck, and give them an hour's instruction each. Two were able to watch the mistakes of the other one all the time. At the end of the week, we would submit them for their driving test on the Saturday morning, and we had a very high success rate. Very few failed, and if they did, if it was one of Gannon's men that failed, he came to me, and vice versa. And I think we had a total of three complete failures in total. One chap, he could drive one way, but once you taught him one thing, he couldn't remember the next, so that was it.
What vehicles were they driving?
We were teaching them all on Ford V8s.
And you're doing the driving training. What other training was involved in this that you're discussing? Other than driving, you said that every man had to...
Had to learn to swim. Yeah. Well, at that point, I'd been trying very hard and hadn't got off, but I did get off then. I learned to swim.
Where were you learning to swim?
Down at the swimming baths on the Kola Goldfields. Beautiful baths. We learnt there.
So, in effect, you were being trained to do anything that might crop up?
Anything.
Because of casualties to others?
Yes.
And rifle training?
We had to... All weapon training, as I say, we all had to be infantrymen first and foremost. And bayonet drill. And, of course, until now, we'd never had a full complement of weapons because it wasn't necessary in the artillery. Artillery was always supposed to be well back. But now, every man was armed. And different weapons. I know... I alternated between a revolver and a Tommy gun and a rifle, and eventually a Sten gun.
Of those weapons, which did you like the best?
Well, the handiest was the revolver, because I could carry on work and it was always with me.
And the Sten, how did you find Sten gun?
The Sten gun was a funny gun, and in my opinion, but it was cheap to produce, and it served a purpose. And we could fire. It didn't have a very long range. I think about 30 yards was its range, which was barely more than what a revolver would do.
Grenades, did they come into your training?
Oh, we threw grenades, yes.
And was this basically an open country? You hadn't got into the jungle training situation?
No, it was open. We did get into some... I wouldn't say jungle as such, but we did get into some sort of jungle area at times on the manoeuvres. We also did... It was referred to as a living on the land exercise. We went away from our camp to this beautiful hill station, Uttarakhand, And it was there that... Oh, no, we'll let them... Uta Kamund was a hill station that people in the state of Mysore used to go to during the hot season. We were encamped alongside this beautiful lake outside of the town, but there were a few houses on the high side of the road. We weren't under canvas, we were just sleeping out in the open beside our vehicles. A friend of mine who drove the water wagon had to go to a big house on the left-hand side of the road to get water. And this lady invited him to bring two or three of his friends for tea one afternoon. They could see us living out there in the open. And so the three of us went round for tea this day. And this lady had a friend and her little daughter there. We had tea out on the veranda. And when we'd had our tea, the lady said to her little daughter, said, "Go and show these gentlemen where the leopard was last night." And the blessed leopard had been on the garden just across the road from us. I can tell you, we all made a sort of an impromptu tent that night to sleep under.
Was this an English family?
English, oh yes. Lovely people.
And what else were you doing there?
As far as our quartermaster went, he was purchasing food for us to live on. Whilst we were there, we sort of relaxed a bit. We did ride one or two ponies, but they were so small we didn't feel it was right to get on them. There was this lovely boating lake, and we sailed on those. And we did get into the bazaar to have a look round there, all the various things, the snake charmers and whatever else. Now, this lady had told us that there were a lot of black panthers in the area. As the sun was going down, she would definitely go out and look round to see if any sheep or goats or cattle had been left out, because she had a big stable and she used to help to get all these things under cover for the night to safeguard them. Well, while we were beside this lake, these big convoys of natives would come along with their bullock carts. And it was, of course, in the dark, with big torches going. Those are flame torches, not electric torches. Those going, crashing cymbals, those at the back of the convoy were virtually walking backwards because they were so frightened that they might be caught, because the black panther tends to hide on trees and drop down onto its prey just for the sake of killing. They also had big pins through the axle, bent over, and these pins were to keep the wheel on. But hanging from the bent over pin, they had tins with pebbles in, and or other tins tied to them. So that each time the wheel bumped the pin, it caused it to rattle. So they were making quite a din as they progressed along the road.
So that must have been quite a scene.
Oh, it had to be seen to be believed.
We're still essentially based around the goldfields at this point in time.
Oh, no, we're miles from the goldfields. It was a 100-odd miles, I think, to Uta Kamund from the goldfields. Now, when we left Uti to go back to the goldfields, we encamped one night beside this beautiful dam, the Krishnaragasagar Dam. And it happened to be a Saturday when we were very lucky to park beside it, because there's an area, just a mass of fountains, and we were told the highest one was 150 feet, and they were all floodlit with different colours, and what a sight it was. Not far from there, some of us went swimming, but it was dangerous ground because it was very potholy. You could be walking on clinker one moment, and the next moment the next foot would disappear down a hole. so it was dodgy. So a few of us went swimming, and I'd only recently learned to swim, so there was a chap swimming beside me just to make sure I could manage all right, and I'd swum well out, and we were about 50 yards away from the shore, and someone shouted, "Crocodiles." So I can tell you there was a wild rush to get back, and I swam so hard that when I got to the shore, I didn't put my feet down in case I went down a hole, and I just beached till I tore my chest open on the rough clinker. But and I bashed one of my toes on another one, but never mind. Fear does all sorts of things to you.
So did you...
And it was all a false alarm, there weren't any.
And your own condition, did that stop you from doing what you were doing? Did you have to go to the medical people?
Oh, no, I just... that day I didn't see the doctor at all, but I had to see the doctor. My toe was in a bad state by we finally got back to camp. It was going septic. But where I'd torn my chest open, that was healing.
And then you went back to the goldfields, I think you said,
yes.
After that. So what was the? Can you describe the townships of on the goldfields?
Yes, well, there were shops and things like that. It was an English area, and they had dances, and all sorts. The troops were invited to the dances, which were pretty often, and then from an early stage, once they'd sort of put lorries on to go down, I used to go down on a Sunday night to the church. And I used to like to go there. And there were three of us, a gang of three. And we made friends with some people out there who I've since visited back in this country. He was a tin miner from Cornwall, from Perranporth. And they were a lovely couple, a small family. And we used to go there after church on a Sunday evening. They insisted we went every Sunday evening for tea. Another chap that was with us, he was a professional artist. He had a cousin who was married to a tin miner out there. And they lived in a beautiful bungalow, and they had us to dinner one night. So it was... You know, it was quite good living down there. And the people that we used to see on a Sunday night, they told us they were supposed to go home to England every 3 years. But because of the war, they couldn't. And they were getting this extra living allowance. And that living allowance enabled them to leave their salary intact. And they could pay for their servants and everything out of this allowance that they got from the gold mines.
I asked you about the relationship between the army and the natives. What was the relationship between the civilians and the native population?
Oh, excellent. They had us down the gold mines. I was fortunate to be able to go down both with the army, and then I spent a leave with these people, and he took me down and we... walked underground right to the face.